So I want to talk today about metta and the world, and metta and the worldly winds. In this world, suffering is all around us. And this, of course, as you know, is the first noble truth that the Buddha spoke about. He said, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Association with the disliked is suffering. Separation from the liked is suffering. Not to obtain what one wants is suffering. And as we sit here and do the metta practice, we repeatedly encounter our naive and immature ideas of the way things should be. We think somehow the world should satisfy us. Somehow the world should be fair, predictable, reliable. And that there's security to be had in anything, fill in the blank, relationship, job, identity, you name it. We sometimes think, oh, good people shouldn't suffer. And that death and illness will, well, we know they'll happen someday, but not today. Not anytime soon, we hope. And we have these assumptions. But of course, none of these is particularly realistic, because this realm that the Buddha called samsara, this world, this conditioned existence, is not supposed to work. It just doesn't. That's its nature. That's that first noble truth in a nutshell. So what does this have to do with metta? It's a good question. Those of you who came for the second half have been working with the difficult category. Those of you who've been here since January have also been grappling with this category. And when we work with people in this difficult realm, we see so clearly how we live in denial of that first noble truth. Because it's our conditioned instinct to blame other people for our suffering. I'm suffering because of what they did. But, of course, making them the problem when it's, in fact, we're clinging to something that we can't control. And it's that very clinging that is the problem. The suffering is coming from here, not from out there. And in our metta practice, as in our life in the world, often when we're challenged in relationships, or challenged in relationship to ourselves, it's because of what the Buddha described as the eight worldly winds. Here's what he says in the Anguttara Nikaya. The world revolves around these eight worldly conditions. What eight? gain and loss, disrepute and fame, blame and praise, and pleasure and pain. An uninstructed worldling, in other words, all of us who are not awake, an uninstructed worldling does not understand as it really is. Gain obsesses his mind, and loss obsesses his mind. Fame, disrepute, blame, praise, pleasure, pain obsess his mind. He is attracted to gain and repelled by loss, and so on with the other worldly winds. Thus involved with attraction and repulsion, he is not freed from sorrow, lamentation, pain, dejection, anguish. He is not freed from suffering, I say. The Buddha was a genius in packaging big things in very pithy packages. These eight worldly winds are a very brief description of all the ways we can experience change in the world and suffer on account of it if we're not really paying attention. And this points directly to the fact that the root of suffering lies not in these events of life, because they're universal. The world revolves around the eight worldly winds, the Buddha says. They're universal. But in our responses to those changes. And in this, some of us are naturally resilient, and others of us crumble at the least little shift and the slightest challenge. Pain, physical and mental, physical pain, heart pain, both, are subjective, individual. And we tend to think our way of experiencing this dukkha, this suffering, is the way everybody does. We think what we experience is the same as what others experience. But that's simply not true. In terms of physical pain, I'm sure most of you have encountered the pain scale that doctors ask you about. You know, how does that feel on a scale of 1 to 10? And what elicits a 3 or an 8 for me is really different than what elicits a 3 or an 8 for somebody else. But pain is pain. And that is the universal experience. So whether I experience an 8 from a broken bone or a paper cut is irrelevant. That an 8 is an 8. It's anguish. And a valid experience to be met with by compassion. Likewise, there's really no single measure for emotional pain, and it's not for people not trying to figure some way of, you know, having a scale for emotional pain that they can use in studies. But it's the same as along the same lines as physical pain. You have to ask for what are you feeling? How are you experiencing this pain? How intense is it? And that answer you receive from yourself or somebody else is a valid one. Even if we don't think it's valid for that person. So So resilience is something that comes with suffering, with working with suffering. And one person can adjust to terrible things in their lives with grace, while another might crumble under the least pressure. Whatever, suffering on account of these eight worldly winds is suffering. And whatever habits or conditioning we each have around the changing nature of life and around pain itself either amplifies the pain or leads us out of it. And that resilience is really determined by whatever habitual and conditioned ways we have to cope or not with this dukkha, this suffering. Whatever habitual and conditioned extra layers, or several extra layers, we add on top of what we are directly experiencing. Some people are what we call in English drama queens or kings. And at some points in our lives, we're drama queens and kings. Teenagers are particularly good at that. And some people never seem to grow out of that. You know, every moment is an operatic aria. I mean, I can chuckle about this because I've had my moments myself. And some people are much more stoic about everything. I had a friend in New Zealand break her leg on my driveway, and she said, "Oh, it hurts a little bit." She was sitting there, and she says, "Oh, it's broken." And she was sincerely not troubled by this, nor was she stoic. It was just she had a very high pain threshold, because she'd experienced in her life a lot of physical trouble and had gotten used to it. And I thought, oh, a broken toe in me felt a whole lot worse than that, you know. But that's, you know, resilience is not something we come with. It's something we grow. And it's also partly cultural. It's really interesting to compare the resilience, the cultural resilience of people in Burma, people from Europe, people from the United States. It's really different. And that's not to make people from places where there's less resilience worse. It's just that's what they've been marinating in. So it's a big part of the practice to build habits of resilience that can be with pain and change and challenge without that additional drama of suffering on account of it, without the reactivity and identification that make it such a big deal. Life really throws us in the middle of this inner landscape. And the metta practice actually offers us one route out of it, out of being stuck in our stories of suffering. Which is why the work you've been doing with anger in the last days, with the difficult person, is a wonderful example of this. And I spoke about it, Ariya has spoken about it, Sayadaw has spoken about it. I want to speak a little bit more about it today. I think there could be a whole retreat on anger because it's such a potent force in our lives. Whether we want to admit it or not, whether it's strong or not. And in these categories of difficult people. We see it vividly. And sometimes it's so interesting to hear what people have to say. It's like, oh, I really didn't think I had any anger, but oh my, there's a lot in there. And if we know we have anger, we see the kind of the scope of it. We see the size of the cloth. And it can be very sobering. It's like, oh, wow, this is everywhere. But of course, with the metta practice, what we do with this is just let it be there. To radiate metta anyway. We see it. We have to come to terms with it. How often it arises. How often it arises simply from these worldly winds. In an interpersonal context. And this is what's so interesting to see in this lens of the worldly winds. Because the difficult people in our lives are the ones that face us with those winds. They put those winds in our face, or they blow them in our face. So maybe their praise turns to blame. Maybe they're talking about us behind our back. We didn't mind it when they were praising us behind our back, but we don't like it when they're talking about us behind our back. Of course not, you know. Or maybe somebody got the job that we thought we would get and still think we deserve more. We lost that opportunity and they gained it. This can be a really poisonous kind of place of practice. All these little workplace dynamics. Or somebody did something that directly affects our health. That can be a challenge. That's huge. And so on. And so these difficult people are the ones who have created a situation where we're faced by those worldly winds. And there we are. Now what? And of course, it's the way of the world to seize upon that person and make them the problem. And that can last for a long time if it's a really difficult relationship. Or to make them at fault. And to get really angry and self-righteous about it. This is the way of the world. This is what most people do. But of course, with the metta practice, we see where the blame lies, where that anger comes from. The Buddha had a really wonderful metaphor to use to describe this and to describe how to deal with it. How to deal with anger on account of somebody mistreating us. And it's a wonderful, very apt description of who anger really belongs to. And this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, the Akosa Sutta. And the Buddha is minding his own business. And somebody had come and taken bhikkhu ordination who happened to be a Brahmin from a certain clan. And one of his clansmen was really very upset by this and came storming up to the Buddha and was, you know, berating him and speaking very badly to him, to his face. And here's how the Buddha responds. Thus reviled, the Blessed One spoke to the Brahmin. Well, Brahmin, do friends, confidants, relatives, kinsmen, and guests visit you? Yes, Gotama. Sometimes friends, confidants, relatives, kinsmen, and guests do visit me. Well, Brahman, do you not offer them snacks or food or tidbits? Yes, Gotama, of course I offer them snacks or food or tidbits. But if, Brahman, they do not accept this food, who gets it? If, Gotama, they do not accept this food, I get it back. And the Buddha says, even so, Brahman, you are abusing, you are angry, you are quarreling. All of this is yours. I don't accept it. You alone, Brahman, get it back. This Brahman belongs to you. I love this because I put myself in that situation and I would not be saying that. This is the ultimate karate move, you know, just let it all go by. Don't accept a bit of that abuse. So when people do things to us, instead of getting angry and making them the problem, we don't accept their anger at us. That's theirs. And likewise, it goes, this is where I find this reflection very, very interesting, because the anger doesn't always come in this direction. Sometimes it goes out. And as Ariya said very clearly, you know, being angry at somebody is, you know, drinking poison and hoping they're going to die. So if anger is going out from here, that's mine. And if anger is coming at me, that's theirs. So when faced with situations that cause anger, we have to grapple with it, both in the practice here and in real life. And as I said the other day, we come to choice. Do we feel frustration, anger, despair, or do we cultivate metta? So while working with this difficult category, we see all shades of challenge. And for some people, this choice is relatively easy, to take the metta path rather than the anger path. And for some of us, at some times in our lives, it's relatively easy. Maybe simply right now, because of current conditions, there's nothing that really causes this to come up. There's no stimulus, there's no condition that creates an enemy. And, you know, yeah, maybe we had past enemies, but we've resolved that. So we're going along and maybe it feels quite smooth. And this is where I really loved it, the Sayadaw said, to test this, as I say again. And one yogi mentioned today that they were testing the metta. It felt really easy. And then they thought, what if I imagine talking to this person? Boof. Oh, well, maybe the metta isn't as strong as I thought. So it's very useful as you're working with this category to test it. Imagine talking to that person on the phone or in person, face to face. See how strong that metta really is. See how resilient you really are in the face of those worldly winds. I want to bring up in this context again the simile of the saw, the sutta of the simile of the saw that I spoke about the other day. And you'll remember that's the one where the Buddha spoke about, well, if somebody cuts your arms and legs off, you will radiate loving kindness to them, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. The beginning of this sutta is very, very interesting. The framing story is very interesting. Or not the framing story, but a story in the beginning of the sutta. Because it's all about this testing. It's a story of a slave, Kali, and her mistress, who was a housewife named Vedehika. And Vedehika had a reputation of being very sweet, very kind, very gentle, very humble, very peaceful. And Kali thought, I wonder if she's only nice to me because of the quality of my work, or if she's really nice. She's really all of these things. So, one day she woke up a little late, and Vedehika says, "Hey, Kali, how come you woke up late?" "No reason, I just did." And she continued to do this, Kali, day after day. Each time the response got a little more until finally one day she gets beaten over the head and goes running out into the street, running blood and, you know, saying, "Look, look, look, see, she's not really nice. Just because I woke up late." And it's a wonderful story. And the Buddha says, "So too, bhikkhus. Some bhikkhu is extremely gentle, extremely meek, extremely peaceful, so long as disagreeable courses of speech do not touch him. But it's when disagreeable speech touches him that it can be understood whether that bhikkhu is really kind, really gentle, or really peaceful." So it's like this in the practice. If we give ourselves little reality checks, like Kali to her mistress, but we can do it to ourselves too. How stable is this? How strong is this metta, really, in the face of worldly winds? And really, it's such good news when we see that it's not so strong. Because we're not deluded about it anymore. We may not think that's good news, but it is. That's the whole point of the practice. Seeing through delusion. So these difficult places in the practice where the worldly winds shake us, where anger arises, ill will might arise, judgment, any number of unwholesome mind states. One thing I want to bring in here that can be very, very supportive, and a number of you have mentioned as a natural outflow of the heart, you kind of intuitively have gone here, that can support the heart in the development of metta in these difficult situations is compassion. Compassion, of course, as we've mentioned, is that aspect of metta which inclines to the suffering of another. And understanding that anger in someone else arises, or in ourselves, arises from causes and conditioning, from pain, from frustration, and that unwholesome actions will inevitably have unwholesome, unpleasant consequences. It's that beautiful metaphor, you plant an apple seed, you get an apple fruit, an apple tree. You plant unwholesome seeds, you get unwholesome trees. So if somebody is behaving unbelievably badly, compassion is a place to rest the heart that is wholesome. Because, as we say in English, the other shoe is going to drop at some point. And understanding the cause and effect relationship between anger and suffering, unwholesome action and suffering, as well as the consequences, the karmic consequences of these things. These both bring the heart to an understanding that is so much bigger than our present personal situation. It brings the heart to a place of connectedness and care that doesn't shrink away or strike out. And this is that aspect of metta, when it greets suffering, that offers a really much more mature and balanced apprehension of each other and of the world. It takes it completely as it is, without expectation. Other people are other people. The world is the world. This is a form of balance, of equanimity that comes with metta. And I don't want to speak about equanimity as a Brahmavihara. That's a bigger story, a bigger topic. But rather simply to bring it up as that very homely and practical balance we get about ourselves and other people with this practice, that understands that unlike what can happen in human relationships, where unfairness does seem to exist, the fruit of intentional action, the karmic consequences of intentional action, are always fair. And cause and effect have their consequences. This is in the Brahmavihara chant. This is that single line, kamasaka, ownership of action. Actions have consequences. And soon, most of you will be out in the outer world. All too soon, sometimes it seems. And we need to do this, to have this understanding out there. The world is calling out for action right now. Louder and louder and louder. And I think you all are aware of this. I don't have to say it. So in a few days after this 2 weeks or 1 month, your retreat will continue out there. So I want to speak to this a little bit to kind of shift the focus. Because out there, the worldly winds blow a lot more strongly than they do here. And you have the challenge to take what you've learned in these kind of refined and relatively simple conditions of a retreat center, of a monastery, to take these understandings, this metta, and apply it in the greater realm of your lives and in the larger larger world with real relationships face to face. And I sometimes think of this as, you know, what happens when you take medical students out of the classroom and throw them for the first time into the hospital. It's like, okay, guys, now you get to try it yourselves. It's scary. And it's very real. And most of you have a lot of experience with some form of practice. So I won't belabor you with nuts and bolts of integration, of how to practice at home. Other than to, you know, give you the Nike slogan, which is just do it. And be creative about that. Of course, continue formal sitting if you have time. But there are so many ways to bring the metta alive in life. ...60 seconds doesn't seem like a long time. 60 seconds 60 times a day is an hour. You can do that. So if there are moments in your life where there's a little space, waiting at a traffic light, commuting, riding in an airplane on the way home, that's actually a big block of time. Standing in a queue. Having a fly rock around on your head and feeling annoyed. You know, whatever it is. We have these moments where we can bring the mind to metta for just a few seconds. And that adds up through the day. So the more creative we can be with this practice, the better. Because that world out there is full of scary stuff right now. And if you read the news, the words you hear over and over and over and over are things like extreme, chaotic, unprecedented. Well, maybe in our lifetimes. And I'm probably not alone in watching the mind go to that place of thinking everything would be better or more peaceful without, fill in the blank, somebody or something. But that's just the same thing as we see in our personal relationships. The troubles that plague the world right now, as extreme as they are, as different as they seem, they're not going to go away with the imagined demise of the bad guys, whoever they are. It's our human predicament. There will always be bad guys. People are people. And we can live together like this as yogis in an international community, harmoniously and beautifully. But out in the world, human beings fight. That's what we do. And if it's not one thing, it's another. Power, religion, territory. It all seems so irrational. And how do we respond to this? That's not going to change anytime soon. Again, we are thrown back. One of those worldly winds could be called war and peace. Tolstoy was right, you know. It's like war and peace. This is the human condition. So when things swing from peace to war, how do we respond? And through it all, it's really, really essential we bring into this context those lessons about ownership of action, of balance, that we come to here individually. Because the sorts of things that can be difficult out there seem endless, from neighbors to countries. And in a lot of these situations, we can't do much to change what's going on. So we have to just take a deep breath and do the practice. Wherever we find ourselves and whatever situations we find ourselves in. Know what's coming up in the heart as a result of conditions. Feed that if it's wholesome. Don't feed it if it's unwholesome. Take responsibility for any reacting that's going on, understanding that we own our anger, understanding that other people own theirs, and remembering that story. It's like, oh, okay, I don't have to eat his anger. That's his. And inclining the mind to metta, to compassion. Because really, these are the most effective routes of response, not anger. People say in the world, I need my anger to be effective. But you remember what the Buddha said, hatred never ceases by hatred. It just makes people more pissed off. All you have to do is look at Twitter and you see it in full living color. So inclining the heart and mind to compassion and taking responsibility for how we are, what is going on here, and feeding what is wholesome. And to reflect about situations in ways that bring that balance, that equanimity. In any given situation, what can you do? What is reasonable? What is possible? And what is not reasonable? What is not possible? And reflecting about how you deal with being unsuccessful, because that will happen too. We do our best, but things don't always work. Sometimes we do our best and we fail completely. We fall on our faces. Sometimes the bad guys win. Life is like that. Please don't forget, karma is always fair. And it's not because we're bad people that this is happening to us. It's just causes and conditions, and who knows what from back there is coming to fruition. In the world today, we could get discouraged, but honestly, we don't have that luxury. And just because hatred and violence seem to have won, seem to be winning, that doesn't mean we have to accept them, to become fatalistic, or to give up. I love what His Holiness says about such things. Compassion, he says, is the radicalism of our time. The more you are motivated by love, the more free and fearless your action will be. And if you think you are too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito. I love that example. It resonates here. You can't sleep with that. And that mosquito is so small. I'm sure you all know examples, though, of single people that made a difference. Maybe you were that person and know it yourself. And when you make a difference to one life, you do not know where that goes. You can't possibly know the benefit that comes from that. Aria and I and Greg and three other friends have this wonderful little group we call Metta in Action. And we try to make a small difference in the world. We do make a small difference in the world. And yet we don't walk around saying, oh, it's not enough, we wish we could do more. Because we all know that it's unknowable what good will come out of changing somebody's situation. We have no idea what benefit will come from that. Maybe some kid who we give tuition to, who we give an education to, will become the Prime Minister of Burma. We don't know. Maybe the head of the UN. Maybe a great peacemaker. Or a great business. Who knows? Or maybe they're just going to be a good person. And their light will shine on the world. And so we all have a light to shine in the world. This is that metta heart. And in the face of those worldly winds, the brighter we shine that light, the more of a difference we can make to everybody else around us. I read this wonderful book called No Place to Hide, or I'm sorry, A Good Place to Hide. And it was a story of a group of villages in France and of a couple of people who changed the whole course of the history of those villages during World War II. And it was this wonderful coming together of conditions. After France fell to the Nazis and was separated into two pieces, in the southern part, in Vichy, France, in a village in a high plateau, a very isolated place, a group of villages, there was a pastor, a Protestant pastor. This was an area where there were a lot of Huguenots that had colonized many, many years ago. And so the whole community was Protestant. And the pastor at one of the churches in one of the villages was a ferocious pacifist. And so when France fell and the word went out to everybody, okay, please cooperate, he gave a sermon in this village that galvanized the entire population of that village and the surrounding villages. It was quite remarkable. And during the war, the people in this village and the surrounding villages, all of them, every single one, was involved in hiding people and transporting people to Switzerland. Jewish people, mostly, but others. Together, these people saved probably, who knows how many, it's not quite clear, but at least 3,000, maybe 5,000 people were saved as a result of that one sermon, that one passionate plea. Maybe as many as 8,000 people. One person can say one thing one day and make a difference. One of the things he said, the pastor who got the ball rolling with all of this, his name was André Trochme. He said, to love, to forgive, to show kindness to our enemies, this is our duty. But we must do our duty without conceding defeat, without servility, without cowardice. We will resist when our enemies demand that we act in ways that go against love. And we will resist without fear, without pride, and without hatred. This is the way that fierce love of metta faces the winds of the world. And I find it amazingly inspiring. So may the many seeds you have planted here on this retreat grow, mature, and fruit in a world that is hungry for the taste of metta and for that sweetness. Thank you for your practice here, and thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.